Before we get going, make sure you're subscribed to the show on whatever audio platform you're using, and jump over on YouTube and subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Daily Real Estate Investor. We have shorts coming out daily, as well as these podcast episodes on video. What's up, folks? We're back for another episode of The Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast. Today, Tony and I are going to cover some trending things in the real estate market and industry, chat about our businesses, and just kind of generally talk real estate. There's a few really interesting subjects we're going to cover. Make sure you stay till the end, because we're going to talk about a lawsuit that's going on that could change how things are done in the realtor space with the MLS and realtors and that kind of thing. But some cool topics here we're going to cover. Tony, how's it going, man?
I'm doing good, man. It's a great week. You know, I've gotten recently good news, and we're keep moving forward with our project. So yeah, everything's good. Life is good. It's the weekend, July 4th. But yeah, man, I can't complain.
It's always good to get good news. What was the good news?
Good news is that we are ordering the next five homes, which will be the first five homes that will be occupied. So we're going to start seeing some income in the next couple months in our park. So that's really
great.
Good news.
That's great. So if you have not caught the past episodes that we've done, Tony is currently building a mobile home park, which he's the only person I know that's building a mobile home park. So he bought land, and they're developing the land into lots, and then going to be selling or helping people basically bring in homes that are tenant owned. And it's quite the interesting process to observe. I'll say that. So congratulations on that. That's awesome, man. So let's dive into some of these topics. Let's hit the first one on the list. First one on the list is kind of a fun thing. This won't be long, but I saw this yesterday and I thought this was pretty cool. So Sylvester Stallone, otherwise known as Rambo and Rocky. I like thinking of this as like Rambo versus Adele. The guy lists his mansion in LA for $110 million in 2021. So this is when the real estate market was on fire, right? So I'm sure he was thinking, I'm going to make out like a bandit on this thing. I don't even know what he bought it for, but I'm imagining it wasn't $110 million. Listed in 2021 for $110 million and has not sold the thing until now. Flash forward to now. Well, back then, interest rates were, you could get an interest rate, you know, 3.5%, something like that. If you bought it down, maybe even cheaper. Now, you know, home mortgage rates are like 7%. So, Adele swept in and bought this thing for $58 million.
That's crazy.
So we're talking about a bargain discount deal on this property. And, can you imagine listing something you own for $100 million and getting $58 million?
I wonder how many price drops he did.
I know. So that's
more than half.
Here's the coolest thing about the whole story. So he's got statues in there of Rocky Balboa, two statues, one in the house and one out by the pool. And he's assuming that Adele's going to let him take these statues with him. Well, she requires that these statues come with the property or she won't sell it. She requires that the statues come with the property or she will not buy the property. So
you imagine put it in the clause in the contract, the Rocky Balboa statue stay.
I know.
That's one of the contingencies there.
So she bought the place for $58 million. He let her keep the statues and now she's gutted the entire place. So you got to imagine this from his perspective. He wanted $110 million. She got it for $58 million. So like almost, we're talking like nearly 50% of his asking price. Like try approaching a seller with 50% of their asking price today and see how they react. And then after that, she kept two of the Rocky Balboa statues that he wanted to keep. And after all that, she's gutting the whole house. So I would love to actually hear his comments on this whole thing. But I just thought that was funny. So it appears that she's gotten a deal, but what would a $58 million mortgage payment at 7% be? You know, and let's hope she's not using a mortgage, right? But if she is, whoo, and LA taxes on top of that.
Oh, man. Yeah. She better keep on singing.
Yeah. For real. So I like to think of this as the Rocky versus Adele, Rocky Six movie, and Adele just KO'd Rocky on this one. So, all right, so let's move on to topic number two. Let's talk about the distress showing up in the real estate markets, specifically commercial. Tony, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so we recently spoke this with Matt Verkloff. So if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to that. But man, it's a wave coming. I just recently read in our article that in October and following November, in October is $4 billion of real estate that is coming due. And November, about another $4 billion follows. And this is an opportunity for, number one, for investors to learn from mistakes. You know, we learned a little bit in 2008, and I hope we learn again when this wave comes and goes. And then number two, this is an opportunity for investors to jump in. Now, keep in mind, a lot of this is office space, and that's due to factors. Number one, people working from home. So the income there for a lot of these spaces reduced. Number two, loans come and due, and then we have high interest rates compared to 2017, 18, 19. If you guys don't know, these are adjustable rates. They have like about a 5, 7, 10 year term. So when those terms are coming up due, that means you got to renew your mortgage. So it's going to be some opportunity to jump in and get some of these. However, they cannot remain office space, obviously. So you have to basically get creative and either make them either add value somehow or make it residential if you're able to. I mean, there's some people there that you can just start putting up walls and make some bedrooms out of these or something like that. So yeah.
Yeah. The office space has been really disrupted from, I would say it started with COVID. It was already happening, but COVID just accelerated it. I think COVID accelerated a lot of things that were already happening, but the office space was already being disrupted by all this flexible workspace and work from home type arrangements. When COVID happened and everybody was working from home, or most people were working from home, it made them realize, A, I'm wasting a lot of time on my commute. And then it made these companies realize this really expensive overhead we have of rent for these offices, or even owning these offices, is not necessary. And if the employees were able to produce at the same level they were before, and you can get rid of that overhead, it's better for the business, it's better for the employee because they got flexibility. And I don't know many people that would prefer to spend a couple hours driving every day when they could be working from home if they can get the same amount of work done. There is the downside of not having the community with your coworkers, right? But some people really like that. Some people are in great places with good community with coworkers. Others are not. So a lot of it really depends on your life situation. If you've got a family and little kids, you might rather work at home. If you're single and you go to work to kind of, you know, hang out with your buddies and stuff, that might be different. But overall, it seems like the flexible workspace thing is trending. Working from home is definitely trending. And going into the office is definitely on the decline. And so this is a sector of commercial real estate that I would not touch right now. I would not invest any money there personally. And I know a lot of people that are feeling the same way, kind of like shopping malls. I feel like shopping malls are really getting hit hard. And I see that trend continuing as well because of the disruption that Amazon brought about, right? Walmart's a little different, right? Walmart's something you go to Walmart to get your shampoo, your milk, your whatever. It's got a lot of stuff you need to grab right now. A shopping mall, it's got stuff that you could pretty much order on Amazon. So,
well, you know, even that Amazon, I know Amazon, I don't know if you've seen Jeff Bezos before he retired, he like delivered the goals for Amazon. And if you guys look around, Amazon is bringing up a lot of warehouses, a lot more warehouses, because Jeff Bezos' goal, and whoever's the CEO now, I don't even know the name. Everybody still probably thinks it's Jeff Bezos. But anyways, the goal is to have Amazon deliver same day. When Amazon gets there, if Walmart, Target, this, you know, the big companies that retailers, when that happens, they better keep up. If not, Amazon is going to take on that market. Because again, dude, I mean, think about it. If I'm in the comfort of my home and I need some shampoo, like you mentioned, I can order from my phone and have it here later on in a couple hours versus me going to the grocery store. If you have that capability, getting it at the same price or cheaper, whatever, I mean, I'm always going to choose my phone.
Yeah. So, and then there's always that space for, I need something in the next 10 minutes, right? So you're going to need to go somewhere for that. Like I need a can of soup or whatever for something I'm cooking or whatever. But Amazon's also planning on building brick and mortar stores. So that's when Walmart's really going to be sweating bullets, is when they get their brick and mortar stores and you can check out without having to scan anything. Supposedly you can fill your basket, bag your groceries and walk out and it's already scanned for you. So there's a lot of cool stuff coming. There's a lot of cool stuff coming with all this, but definitely very disruptive with all that's going on. But what were you going
to
say?
Yeah. When I went to London last year, which is weird, I hadn't seen it here. It was an Amazon store, a grocery store. It wasn't like a Whole Foods or anything. It literally said, I think it just said Amazon store at the top. I went in and you literally grab a basket, like, you know, like a handheld basket, and you put your groceries in there. And that's basically the basket is detecting the stuff that you put in there, and you literally just pay with your app and you can walk out the store without, you know, no type of employees or anything. So, and I assume Amazon probably has that in, you know, in Seattle, California area. I'm not sure, but it hasn't come to Alabama just yet. But yeah, man, it's coming to the stores, the retail stores are going to be really affected by it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you guys missed last week's episode on the podcast, and you go check that out, that podcast episode was with Axel Ragnarsson. He's a multifamily guy and he hit on the distress that's going on, or the stress, not quite distress yet, but the stress that's going on in the multifamily markets. And we talked about this briefly a second ago, but the reason for this is fairly obvious, right? The interest rates have gone up so high, so fast. They've been hiked. Interest rates have been hiked at the fastest clip in history in the US. So this is unprecedented what's been going on with our interest rate environment. So when you couple that with the lowering of interest rates rapidly, all the stimulus money that was given out, which created all these asset bubbles, real estate being one of them, and then you hike rates at the fastest clip ever in the history of the US, you can see why there would be stress on the multifamily owners who bought these properties a few years ago. And Axel was talking about how some of these owners didn't really think this through very well, and they bought these on terms where the interest rate is adjusting every 1 or 2 years. And so when interest rates go up, that obviously affects your bottom line profit. Not only have interest rates gone up, the cost of insurance has gone through the roof. The cost of labor has gone through the roof. So this is squeezing the margins of these syndicators and of these multifamily owners. So the investor's not getting the same return. The owner's not getting the same return. And now the bank wants them to refinance. So it's possible that their value has gone down a little bit. So if the value goes down, you got to come to the table with equity, and your interest rate's gone up, which is making things worse because your insurance, your renovations, and all that stuff's already gone up anyway. So you compound that with higher interest rates on deals that were already thin, along with your value's going down, and now you got to bring extra capital to the table. That could really be stressful. So that's what's going on right now in the multifamily. It's going on nationwide in commercial, but it seems like multifamily is really getting hit with it. And Axel was talking about there's not really blood in the streets yet, but it could be coming.
Yeah. And I'll mention something that I'm going to start looking into as me and Josiah looking to buy our first multifamily investment is mom and pop owners usually don't keep up with market rent. And with these interest rates coming in and, you know, being increased, if mom and pop owners left the rents at the, you know, at the wherever they started their tenants, these are going to be folks that their margins are getting smaller and smaller. And this could be an opportunity for anybody to jump in. Real estate is local. So look at your local market, see how everything's affected. Because I know Huntsville, Alabama, it's a strong market right now. There's a lot of jobs coming in. Rent continues to increase. But check your local market and see the opportunities that are coming, whether it's commercial or single family.
Yeah, and this is being recorded June 30th, 2023. So the last time the Fed met, they decided to keep rates where they are. So they decided not to hike. So that's been the first meeting that they've held off on a rate hike in quite a while. So that's signaling to me that they're seeing some signs of inflation slowing down and maybe some distress in the commercial real estate market. There's already banks that have had a lot of stress and that have actually gone under. It's just such an interesting thing to witness from a real estate investor's perspective, because we went from the market was on fire, people were fighting for deals, to COVID and no one would lend money, no one would buy anything. You could barely, it's like you couldn't hardly give a property away there for a few weeks or a few months. Then it just flipped on a dime and went back to on fire because of all the stimulus money and everything opening back up. Then we went to rates are so high now that the only people moving or buying in the residential market are people that are changing jobs or literally had someone make the, like, I know someone that had was made a cash offer that was so high that they couldn't refuse it. So they sold their house in cash. Now they're trying to find something else at a much higher interest rate, but they made so much money, they're going to try to buy something in cash. So, you know, and really the interesting part about that is they had a really nice house. I know they didn't own that house in cash. So they're going to probably have to downgrade the level, the standard of living just based on the house, just to be able to buy something in cash right now. Another problem with this is that there aren't enough properties listed, right? Because, and this is talking about this golden handcuffs that are existing in the current residential market, which the golden handcuffs are referring to, you have a 2 to 3%, maybe 4% interest rate on your residential property, your primary residence. You're kind of handcuffed because if you want to sell that property and go buy the same property somewhere else, across town, you've now got a 7% interest rate. So your mortgage payment's going to go way up for this exact same property. So people are choosing not to sell. They're choosing to stay put, which is creating a supply problem on the listing side, because the people that have to move, that have job changes or whatever, there's not much to buy. So there's not much to buy and it's too expensive. And then the other problem is that there's a shortage of properties listed. So the people that do list don't want to discount their properties, right? So rates are higher, but they're not being, the properties aren't necessarily being discounted. So people are still trying to get 2021, 2022 prices today, but rates are significantly higher, which just means it's so much more expensive to own the same kind of house for the buyer.
Yeah. And I know one of the reasons why interest rates are still at, you know, in this case, averaging a little under 7% is because we're still showing a strong economy. GDP numbers just came out recently, and the Fed were predicting them to be at, I believe it was 1.3, but they came at 2%. So the economy is showing really strong, and the Feds will not see a need if the economy continues to be strong, interest rates will remain high. The moment when the economy starts slowing down, that's when interest rates begin or it's looking like a slowdown. That's when interest rates will reduce because lower interest rate incentivize people to spend more money. So we don't know what's going to happen. A lot of people have been predicting them to be lower by the end of the year. We don't know. I don't think, obviously nobody has a crystal ball what's going to happen. And yeah, man, this is getting, we're living in interesting times. And I think a lot more people are getting used to the 7%, 6% interest rates. So, cause I mean, I think more the sales demand increase. However, like you were saying, Josiah, the inventory has not. So again, we have a lot of people that are still wanting to buy, but we don't have a lot of people putting properties for sale. So this is a very interesting time that we're living in. But again, if you're an investor, you cannot solely depend on the MLS, what's on the market, which we're going to touch on that later. But you have to look off market. You have to get out there. You have to get on the phone, start looking for deals that way. Because as you can see, in the last 2 years, we cannot depend on what's in the MLS. Because you're going to get top price. And honestly, you're never going to get, like, if you guys are familiar with the 1%, the 2% rule, you're never going to get to those levels if you continue to pay market price. So as an investor, you have to look off market. And this is one thing too. This issue, they've been going on since 2021. That forced me personally to start looking into Subject 2. If you're not familiar with Subject 2, we can talk about that on a different day. But in 2022, I purchased 3 properties Subject 2. And to kind of summarize, Subject 2 is basically buying properties, but keeping the seller, with the interest rate. Basically, you're just taking over the mortgage payments. That's one way you could find properties off market. But you have to get creative with the way you find properties and the way you finance these deals. So yeah, it's this residential market, man. It's very interesting what we're dealing with now.
I got a question for you about Subject 2. Mm-hmm. Did you have any issues after you closed that deal keeping that seller financing in place? Did you have any issues getting the payments made? Were there any issues that you'd like to talk about on that?
Yeah, so far, no issues at all. The one thing that we ran into was the insurance. Insurance was struggling to transfer it to our name because the seller was still in the mortgage. And when you send that over to the bank, it shows up my company's name instead of the seller. So the bank says, no, we're not going to set this insurance. And we kept adding it, you know, as an additional insured, the name of the seller, but they still will not take it. So we had to get on the phone with the insurance company and with the bank to try to get that handled. Other than that, we have not had any issues making those payments. It's been pretty smooth. The seller, the majority of what we found was pre-foreclosure properties. So the sellers, they were in really great need for us to take these mortgage payments over because it improved their credit score. And we also gave them cash at the closing table. So it's a win-win situation. And when you do these, make sure you are disclosing everything. You know, there's, again, as a real estate investor, as a person with ethics, you should never take advantage of people. So make sure you disclose everything and you tell people exactly what you're doing. But to finish answering your question, Josiah, no issues as far as what I mentioned. And we found deals that were in the 3% range, 4% range, when interest rates were going in the, you know, when the mortgage rates at the time were in the 7% and 8%. So this is another strategy that you can basically turn back the wheel of time and still get good rates.
I love that. So when you did this Subject 2 deal, mm-hmm. and these properties were in pre-foreclosure, did you have to go back and help them make payments they had missed to catch them up?
Yes. So when somebody is in foreclosure, or let me back up, when somebody start missing payments, not making the payments or monthly mortgage payments, it takes approximately 3 months until the bank, they just send you letters. It takes approximately 6 months until that hits the courthouse steps for auction. So basically, when somebody is in foreclosure, when the bank is getting ready to foreclose on that house, they are behind at least 3 to 6 months worth of payments. And in order to make that transaction, the sales, you have to basically catch them completely on their mortgage payments. So, for example, I'll put one that we purchased back in June of last year. We ended up paying about $12,000 in payments that he was behind. And now that was a special case because he was one of those COVID programs that he didn't pay for like 12 months. And all of a sudden they did him wrong because they put all of those payments to be caught up. He couldn't do it, obviously. So we ended up paying 12 months worth of principal and interest on that.
Very nice. Yeah. And I'll echo what Tony said. You know, subject to is something to be used with caution. You don't want to take advantage of people, but in a situation where someone's going into pre-foreclosure, you could offer them a solution to help them save their credit, get their payments back on track, sell their property, get them into a more sustainable situation in their life. Maybe they've got too many expenses. Their housing expense is just too high and they need to downgrade their standard of living a little bit or something. There are a lot of people that get stuck when they get behind on payments and it just compounds on them. So this could be a solution to really help somebody out. Mm-hmm. So Tony, tell me this. If you were a buyer right now, let's say you had to buy a single family primary residence, mm-hmm. knowing what you know about the markets and where they are right now, what would be your approach?
My approach, number one, would be off market. I'm not taking anything on the market right now. Like I still get my alerts and stuff, but it will be a property off market. Specifically, interest rates being this high, I would go with something subject to. Now, with subject to, keep in mind, like we mentioned, you bring in all this money that you catch them up on the payments. You also incentivize the seller with some cash, and all that money you don't get it back unless you do what we know as a BRRRR. You refinance up to a certain point. You don't refinance the whole thing because then you're probably going to be at a loss, but you just refinance however much that mortgage is due and however much money you put in the deal. So let's say, for example, the balance on the mortgage is 150. Let's say closing costs and cash that I gave to the seller was a total of 10,000. I'm 160,000 into the deal. Let's say I didn't have to make any repairs. 160 is what I'm going to refinance to get all of my money back out. And yes, I'm refinancing at a 7% interest rate. That's today's market, but I still make cash flow because again, rent is probably way above that. And that's what I did for two of the properties that I got in subject to. One of them that I got last year is still under the seller's name. And that one is still cash flowing pretty good. I didn't have to do any repairs to it. So that's the approach I would take in today's market with interest rates being this high. That would be my go-to.
Yeah. So you're basically saying use the subject to approach to take control of the property. Then you could do your refinance, even though you're moving up in rate because you're walking into a good amount of equity. You could essentially burr out of the property, basically get all of your capital back and then own a primary residence with no down payment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another approach. Can I add another one to that?
Absolutely.
Another approach, I would say if there's no inventory, you can build it. And what I mean by that is you can buy a piece of land, random place, market is still hot, people are still looking for homes. Buy a piece of land, you can either subdivide it, or if it's already subdivided, you can just literally get your permits to build a house, you know, build either to rent or build to sale. I know a lot of the folks that I know here locally, they're buying land, building a house from the ground up, and some of them are renting it, some of them are you know, selling it just like a regular flipper. But sometimes, you know, you can get your start off with a construction loan. After you got that construction loan and you move somebody in there, you can refinance and get your cash back. So that's another approach, I would assume, with inventory being like this and the prices being the way they are. That's another good way to, quote unquote, still get a good deal and meet your 1%, your 2% rule, whatever you're looking for.
Yeah. If I were looking for a house in today's market, if I were looking for a primary residence in today's market, I would use the BRRRR strategy to buy a distressed property. I would look through lists with wholesalers, and I would also look online. Sometimes you can find them listed on the MLS, but I would buy a distressed property in an area that I really like, that's got good schools, since I've got kids and whatnot. And I would rehab that property with hard money or private money. Then I would refinance, get as much of the capital back as I could. And I would essentially have what Tony was referring to earlier. I would essentially have a property with no capital of my own involved. I would have hopefully 20% or more equity. And that would be how I would approach this. Even with higher interest rates, if you don't have to put any of your own capital in and you're able to get into an area you like and you get the bonus of having 20% or more equity, this could still be a really good deal for you. So when the market zigs, you have to zag, right? If there's not enough inventory, you got to get creative and figure out a way to create the inventory for yourself, whether it's subject to, whether it's buying distressed and doing the BRRRR strategy on that yourself, whether it's building something, you have to get creative. So you have to come up with a way to create the property that you're having a difficulty finding, and it's still doable. You can buy in any market as long as your numbers work. You just got to get creative sometimes.
Yeah, and I'll add to it. When you're calculating a refinance, you know, your numbers on a refinance, make sure, because of how the market is, make sure you're at least 1% above what's today's interest rates. Because we've seen in the last 6 months, we had a lot of rate hikes. So when you're calculating your refi as part of your BRRRR, make sure you are conservative. Just so your numbers work regardless of what happens in the market.
Love it. Let's quickly shift to another topic that has been trending lately, and that is the short-term rental market. Let's talk about the short-term rental market and some data that is materializing. I saw a tweet a couple days ago, and it was saying something to the effect of the short-term rental market is crashing. The data looks really bad in all these markets. It had, number one, the biggest decline in Sevierville. It had like negative 40% on there. And there wasn't any info about what that meant. But, you know, most of my properties are in Sevierville, Pigeon Forge area, my short-term rentals. All of our stuff is completely booked. So I found that statistic to be shocking. And I have some doubt around what they're meaning by that. But there are some problems going on in short term, specifically in big cities, where a lot of product has come online, like Arizona, Phoenix specifically. There's a lot more properties that have come online, which obviously as the supply goes up, the demand for your property, everything held constant, is going to go down if it doesn't have some, you know, really exciting amenity, a rare amenity that they can't get anywhere else. You know, if it's got an incredible location that's not comparable to everything else, like it might stay booked and unaffected. But if it's just a house, 3-bedroom, 2-bath house in a neighborhood comparable to everything else, and you know, you triple the supply, then obviously demand's going to go down and occupancy is going to go down some. So, and then you have what happened in Dallas, which is they just passed a law saying that you can no longer have short-term rentals zoned in single-family neighborhoods. You can no longer have short-term rentals, and there's thousands of short-term rental owners there that are having to work through this now. And this has been the reason that I have stayed out of short-term rentals in cities like Dallas, and stuck with the kind of the vacation rental niche up in the Smoky Mountains and the Pigeon Forge, Gatlinburg, Sevierville area, because that's like apples and oranges. You know, an Airbnb in Dallas, Texas, in a three bed, two bath house in a neighborhood there, in the suburbs, is much different than a vacation rental cabin sitting on the side of a mountain, you know, with a hot tub on the back deck and a movie theater in it. You know, like those are completely different assets, and the risk profile of both are different to me. The reason being, Dallas or the city you're in could change the short-term rental laws at any moment, and then all of a sudden you can't do it anymore. The first thing I asked when I was looking at going into short-term was, what's the probability of them making this illegal? And the thing I liked about that Pigeon Forge, Gatlinburg market was that entire market, the backbone of that market is tourism. And people travel up there and they want to stay in a cabin because they're in the Smoky Mountains. There's black bears. There's, you know, it's like they want the mountain experience, and staying in a cabin is part of that. So it's not frowned upon at all. It's very welcomed there. So there is a high probability that they don't make that illegal. So that makes my investment much safer. That takes that risk factor down. Now, one risk is that they overbuild it, right? But since costs have gone up so much and interest rates have gone up, that's going to slow down the building. But if you buy a property that's well located, that's well managed, that has good amenities, you should do just fine. And so we're doing the very best we can on management. We have a great property manager. The properties are very well located. They've got great views. They've got great amenities. We fixed them up. We take great care of the guests, and our properties are completely booked out. So when I see this statistic saying Sevierville's down 40%, I don't know what 40% that is, but it's definitely not us. So I'm guessing that if you manage your property well and you buy a well-located property, you're going to do just fine. What are your thoughts, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, we've all known that in the last couple of years, the short-term rental Airbnb has been, in a sense, overly saturated. I know, I think I saw that same article that you're talking about, and they had cities at number one being, not number one, but like at the top being Denver, Phoenix, Dallas, like you mentioned, Myrtle Beach, and several other places. But, think about it for a second. Since Airbnb and the short-term rental space was blowing up, it was eventually going to come to an end. We knew this was going to happen. Number one, number two, a lot of, sellers, instead of a lot of homeowners, instead of selling, they're keeping their homes as rentals because this is what's hot right now. So when they realize that this is more work than they expected, this is what happens. Now, of course, when it comes to short-term rentals, I lost my train of thought, but basically this is something that we kind of knew it was coming. Like you mentioned, places like Sevierville, Tennessee and the Pigeon Forge area, that's definitely a place where people want to stay in cabins because that's part of the attraction over there. However, in places like this, you have to think of Marriott, Hampton, Hilton, all those companies, those are big corporations, and they had a huge market going on when it came to short stays. Hotels were the only thing that were known. Now you have all these individuals that are taking over their market. And again, these companies with a lot of power, these companies with a lot of money, and these companies that have a big stake at the economy, now they're telling city officials, county officials, hey, you need to make this illegal or charge a really high tax. That way we can stay in competition. And that's exactly what's happening. Again, tourist areas are not affected, but local cities, local towns that tourism is not a big thing, those areas could be affected. Again, we saw that in Dallas, like you mentioned, Josiah, and that could happen any other place. So one thing, if that's solely your business in real estate or the majority of your business, you have to start looking at making that process offline. And what I mean by that is going direct, you know, create your own. Listen, do not depend solely on Airbnb, VRBO, where your properties are listed. Create your own site and create a Google ad, and that's fairly cheap, for your properties to come up at the top when people look up Phoenix, Arizona, short-term stays. Create your website. Create something that doesn't allow you to solely depend on Airbnb, VRBO. Because again, guys, this is something that, because of the saturation, we kind of knew it was going to happen, and it could affect a lot of investors. This is another opportunity for you to jump in, because maybe a lot of these short-term rental homeowners are going to maybe put these in the market, or they're going to sell it at a dirt cheap because they're not making the same cash flow as they thought they were going to get. So keep a lookout for that as well. This is something that I'm going to keep a lookout myself. So like I said, we're living in some interesting times.
Yep. Yeah. As I think it was Warren Buffett that said, when the tide goes out, you can tell who's been swimming with no clothes on. Right. So what that means is, you know, if you bought a vacation rental and everything's hinging around it being, or sorry, you bought an Airbnb in a single family residential neighborhood, everything is hinging around it being an Airbnb and the numbers don't work as a long-term rental, you need to rethink that strategy, right? Because you always want to know what's my worst case scenario and have multiple escape plans. So let's transition to our last story. Before we do that, if you made it this far, thank you. And please hit the like button if you're watching this on YouTube. Also, if you're not subscribed, please subscribe. We would appreciate that. We try to put out a good amount of free content for you guys to help you. You could help us in a free way by hitting the like button and subscribing and even sharing this with your buddies. Last story. I read that there are multi-billion dollar lawsuits going on against the National Association of Realtors, accusing them of using the MLS, the multiple listing service, and the MLS rules to basically benefit and fatten the pocketbooks of the real estate agents. They're saying if these lawsuits actually, you know, if the plaintiffs win the lawsuits, then this could actually rewrite the rules around how properties are listed and sold going forward. So this seems like a big deal to me. I mean, I am a licensed broker in multiple states, and I've always thought that the multiple listing service is the closest thing you get to a monopoly, a legal monopoly in the United States, because there is not another multiple listing service. You cannot access the multiple listing service in the same way that an agent can if you are not a licensed agent. Like a person that's not a licensed agent cannot go list their property on the multiple listing service. So they've really created a competitive moat around the multiple listing service, which does ensure that the agents are able to make fees off of buying and selling real estate. That being said, the agents are providing a great service by helping people buy and sell their properties. A lot of agents sometimes get a bad rap because people say, oh, well, I have to pay this agent this much to sell my house. And then you see them, they'll take their house off. They'll take their listing down and go list it as for sale by owner. It'll sit there for 6 months because it's not listed at the proper price and they don't have good pictures. Nobody, you know, they've got a like homemade sign in their yard, and it's like, you're costing yourself so much money. If you just hired an agent, you would have already had this sold, probably made more money. And net of the agent fees, if you can make the same amount of money or more, you want to use an agent, right? Nothing wrong with selling your property for sale by owner. But if you can make more money selling it through an agent and it's better for your overall game plan, you want to do that, right? So it's going to be interesting to see how this lawsuit pans out and who wins. And I do think there is a chance that the MLS and the way things are the way things work going forward regarding the MLS could change. What are your thoughts, Tony?
Well, I was going to ask you, have they said specifically how the agents were or the MLS was promoting these agent fees? Is it just pricing? Did they say anything about that in the article?
You know, I read one article. So there's two lawsuits. I haven't read both. I hadn't read information about both. I know one was claiming that people were upset that the seller was paying not only the seller's agent, but the buyer's agent as well. It's one of those things. It's like, well, you agreed to it. You agreed to it up front. It's kind of odd to be upset about it. That'd be like going to McDonald's and them saying it's $5 for a Happy Meal. And you saying, it's not really fair that you guys charged me $5 for this Happy Meal because I didn't want a drink with it or whatever. It's like, well, you ordered the Happy Meal for $5, you know? So it's like they're agreeing to this up front, but then they're not happy about having to pay for the seller's agent fees. So anyway, we'll see what happens with it. I think, you know, overall there's people that a good number of people that feel like the MLS is kind of an antitrust issue, and it's too much of a monopoly on the data and the way to list and sell your property. So I think that's at the core what's going on. We'll see how it all shakes out.
Yeah, man, that'll be very interesting. Cause I mean, me personally, I've never liked the fact of paying, you know, agent fees, or at least, you know, my agent is fine, but paying for the other agent's fees. I get it. You know, I agree to it. I've only sold one property, ever since I started buying. And I remember, I mean, I was kind of like, man, why am I paying for this guy? but yeah, it's, like you said, it all goes back to, the terminating negotiations, because maybe you agreed to pay for the buyer's agent, but at the same time, you can negotiate how much money is brought to the table or how much of a discount do you give. I mean, there's a lot of things you can negotiate. Lesson learned for me, make sure you read everything when you sign a contract. Something I don't like, for example, DocuSign, when you're signing a document virtually, DocuSign just takes you to the signature portion. It doesn't even let you, you know, you have to scroll up to read things. So make sure you read a contract completely. And that's probably why this lawsuit is going on, because a lot of people did not read their contract. They were just signing, where do I sign? You know, and the agents, of course, agents, in a sense, a lot of them don't care. They just want their 3% when they sell the property. So a lot of them just care that the property actually gets sold. The only one that's going to care the most about yourself is yourself. So read the paperwork, man. You got to read the paperwork, read the small fonts. So
yeah, on multiple occasions at the closing table, I have sat there and gone through what I was signing and looked at the numbers closely and found well over $1,000 mistakes by the title company and whatnot. So always take the time to go through your closing documents, and you're saying, well, that those documents should have been to you 24 hours before closing. Yeah, they should have, but a lot of times they don't get them to you 24 hours before closing. So they give them to you when you show up, and they want you to sign them and not look at anything. Multiple occasions I've found several $1,000 mistakes that if I had just signed, the money would just be gone. Nobody would have ever known. So
yeah.
So always look through your documents. That's a great tip.
I know one time, real quick, before we transition into the next thing, I was at a closing table for it was actually a bird property. We got it at a good price. However, this was a wholesale property, and the wholesaler, they had an assignment fee of $35,000, which was true. I mean, again, that's how our COVID times were. Wholesalers were making a lot of good money. So even with the $35,000 assignment fee, it was still a good deal for me, and it panned out to be a great deal. However, when we were at the closing table, I was looking at the HUD settlement. They send it super late, which is not good. I mean, a HUD settlement should be sent a day or two before you get to the closing. However, that attorney was they were late. Anyway, when I saw it, they had the purchase price with the fee, the wholesale fee included on there. And then on another line item, they had it again, just the wholesale fee. So if I was to agree to that, that means I would have been at a loss. I mean, I'm pretty sure that could have been fixed, hopefully. But if I didn't cash that, that was going to be $35,000 that I was going to be short. So always be sure to read your documents. It don't matter if the attorney, you know, when you get to the closing table, if the attorney is looking at you, putting some pressure on you, you know, trying to hurry up for you to finish reading, take your time. You're in a legal standpoint to read your documents. That's what you're supposed to do. So,
yeah, one time at the closing table, I, you know, painfully looked through all the documents, read through them all, and the HUD was going through each number, to the dismay of the title company employee. But I found that the lender had not given me my full credit on my closing costs. So there was several thousand dollars of just closing costs that were not applied to my side that should have been. So they fix it, save me $2,500. So, and it can be a lot more than that. Like you were just saying, Tony, it could be an assignment fee that got doubled up on there, and it's double charging you for $35,000. So look through those numbers. So that's all we got today. We'll try to do this more often, where we have kind of a general chat about what's going on in the market and trending news items. But that's all I got. Tony, you got anything to wrap us up?
Just make sure, if you're also listening to this episode on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, make sure you leave us a 5-star rating that tells Apple or Spotify that this is actually a good show. So if you got some value out of that, make sure you hit that 5-star. And again, follow us on YouTube and hit that like button.
Appreciate it, guys. We love y'all. We'll see you next time.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please connect with me on Instagram at Daily Real Estate Investor or via email at josiahsmelser@gmail.com. My new book titled Dream It and Build It, How to Crush Your Real Estate Investing Goals is out. You can get it either in digital or physical format on Amazon. Once you've read the book, please leave me a review. Tune in next time for another episode of the Daily Real Estate Investor as we both join in our financial freedom journey.